Brian Had a Dream. 10,000 movies, 40 years. This is his journey, and this is your invitation to join along. This is the quest for 10,000.
Hi, once again, I'm Ben.
And I'm Brian.
And welcome to the quest for 10,000, our audio journey with Brian as he tries to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. We are back after a long hiatus. Real world life came into conflict with this podcast. Brian and I used to be in the same town. Now we're in different towns because that's right. I moved for work, and Brian stayed where he is, and so it's taken us some time now to get back, but here we are. This episode should be dropping right as Brian is nearing his 39th birthday. So that means he has 1 year and change left to hit the 10,000 movie mark. So we'll talk a little bit about that in this episode. We'll also do a little bit of a different top five, talking just about what we feel are sort of the five, the bigger stories that have happened since we last recorded an episode, which was our preview review of Infinity War. But as always, Brian, we have to begin. Where are you on the quest for 10,000?
Hot off the presses, I'm at 9,634.
What? Yeah. What? That's like just a little over one movie a day.
It's actually probably a little less than one movie a day. I feel it. I'll finish up well ahead of time. What I'm doing now, since I'm ahead of schedule, is I'm going through and rewatching movies that I couldn't necessarily tell you when I had watched them. So just so I can say that, you know, have that idea in my head and know when I've seen them.
Okay, so now you're sort of playing with the time you've banked already, but you got to be careful because we know from previous experience that you don't want to rest on your laurels. What are some of the movies you've been rewatching?
Well, the rewatching, let's see, today I rewatched Star Trek, the motion picture. And a couple days ago, a movie that you know it's good. In the back of my mind, I love the movie, but I forget how good it is, Stranger Than Fiction. It's one of the best movies, maybe the best Will Ferrell movie.
It is a pretty good movie. I like that one a lot with Will Ferrell. I listened to a podcast recently about Step Brothers and was convinced about the high degree of difficulty improvising with that and the underrated nature of Adam McKay as a director, too. But that's probably questions for a different time. What is the last brand new movie that you watched?
The last movie I'd watched I had not seen before is a romantic comedy from the 60s starring none other than everybody's favorite romantic leading man, John Wayne.
You had me until you said John Wayne.
It's Hatari. It's a movie. He's a big game hunter, and he's leading a group. And it's just awkward. Howard Hawks directed it. It's okay. I mean, I enjoyed it. John Wayne is not romantic leading man material.
God bless John Wayne. I do like John Wayne and John Wayne movies, but he tried so hard to get out of the kind of typical John Wayne role, and it just never worked. So, well, tell me this. It's been since the end of May that we recorded an episode, and so sort of the theme of this episode is just kind of catching up a little bit. So maybe tell us, too, about the best movie that you've seen in a movie theater since we last recorded.
The best movie I've seen in a movie theater is maybe one of the best movies of the year, The Incredibles 2.
Yeah.
That movie was... I don't quite think it was, you know, Incredibles-level stuff, but darn close. I mean, there was a hair's breadth difference between the two. And it was just a good movie, you know, really great movie. A little obvious, maybe, but you know, a really good movie.
I loved it. It was a movie we went to go see with our son in the new town we're living in the first weekend that we were here. So that may explain some of my affinity for it, just to associate that memory with it. But he loved it.
Oh, it was great.
Our son has struggled with getting scared in movie theaters when the lights go down and something happens. But this one kept his attention, and he was just so excited all the way through. He loves Dash. He wants to be Dash. And I really enjoyed it a lot more. I felt like it showed a little bit more of the background of that world, some of the depth and nuance and texture of it. So I really enjoyed it. And I really loved, too, how right before the showing that I saw, I don't know if this was true in the theater when you saw it, how they had the cast kind of come out and say, yeah, it's been a long time, we know, we're sorry, but here it is. I kind of appreciated that as a bone they threw to fans. So I agree with you. One of the best movies I've seen all year. So what about a top movie you saw that just wasn't in a theater? You mentioned these rewatches in Stranger Than Fiction. Are there any other movies that were brand new to you that you just want to mention?
Yeah, one of the movies, I was not even really aware of the movie, except I do sort of pay attention to the Emmy nominations, and this movie was nominated for an Emmy. It's a couple of Emmys, and it's a Laura Dern movie called The Tale, about a survivor of sexual abuse who sort of, in her mind, whitewashes over those memories, and then something happens where she gets, her mom finds something and sends her, and it opens this floodgate, and she's sort of coming to terms with and realizing that's why I have trouble in relationships, that's why I'm like this, that's why I'm like this, and sort of working through that. It was really powerful. I love Laura Dern. Ellen Burstyn is in it, and I love, especially older Ellen Burstyn, love her. Jason Ritter, John Ritter, he's the sexual assaulter, and he is incredibly creepy in the movie. But it was really, really good.
I'll share my favorite movie not seen in a theater. I watched this movie on a plane. As we were heading for a vacation before we moved, I finally got to see, and probably wouldn't have seen it if not for a malfunction in the in-flight movies with Delta, where only the children's movies were able to be accessed. And so I finally saw Coco.
Oh, Coco's so good.
And it was amazing. It was amazing. I might even put it... I put it up against, I know it's not Pixar, but I put it up
Coco
against...
Coco is Pixar.
Is it Pixar?
Yeah, it's Pixar.
It might be my favorite. Coco might be now my favorite Pixar movie. I bawled.
That is in my top five.
At
and
the
I
end,
Coco,
it was just
Coco,
so good.
Coco, to me, you know how, and I've said this to several people, and I may have said it to you already, but Up, you ramp it up, and you're like in tears 10 minutes in, and then you sort of, you know, sort of plateaus off from there. Coco is up in reverse. Because the last like 15 minutes of Coco are just like melting. Like you are just like, I cannot believe how much this is getting to me.
It's just amazing. It's
I know, it's
the
like
best.
Where's my mom? Where's my dad? Where's
it's
my
the best.
I gotta give everybody a hug.
It's
like,
the best, right. I was sitting next to my wife and son on the plane, so and she saw I was crying and she was like, you're a wimp, but I was like, no,
like,
you need
I
to watch this
give
movie.
You a big enough hug right now.
Right. Right. The dog, the spirit, animal, just so good. Very good. Very good movie. So at this point, we're going to jump in now, having caught up on a couple of films, just talk about some stories. So kind of our consensus top five most interesting things to Brian and myself that have happened in the film industry, pop culture, what's contributed to kind of discourse about movies and things happening in movies. So Brian's going to kind of take the lead on mentioning number five and number four. I'm going to mention number three and number two. We'll both jump in various ways and talking about those. And then number one will be, we'll kind of balance that one out. So Brian, tell us number five for you.
Well, number five, we've sort of hinted at this, and it's sort of been discussed in several think pieces probably over the last two or three years. And some of it just on a numbers level, it makes sense why it would work out this way. But I looked at it before we went to air here, and as of the end of July, the top 10 movies gross-wise, you know, money-wise for the year, four of the top 10 are from the Chinese market. Made in China, and I think that this summer it seems to be accelerating, that Chinese movies just are driving a lot of the box office. Not just in that's where our movies can go to recoup some, you know, even duds can make money overseas or so, but homegrown Chinese movies that are now as big, if not bigger, than a large number of blockbusters here, and I think that's only going to increase, and it's just going to be interesting to see what kind of dynamics and how many movies start getting made for China first, and we're a secondary market, and there's even Hollywood movies.
Yeah, that is to me the key on that becoming a bigger story, and why I think it's appropriate number five, because it's something you got to take note of. But what sort of is the thing that fully pushes the dynamic so that you know we're a secondary market?
Well, you look at a movie like what Matt Damon did, like what last year, the year before, The Great Wall.
Right.
I mean that was clearly trying to like get ahead of the curve and break into this and tap into this market and do exactly that. Make a movie with an American star that's really made for a Chinese audience and see how that goes. It was a test. I think you're just going to see a lot more. There's a distinct style. Even Chinese, some of the fantasy movies that they've been churning out over the last probably half decade to decade are really inventive and creative because they're dealing. And part of that is because of source material. You know, you go see a fantasy film, a Western fantasy film, I've seen all those tropes. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I know all that source material. I know what you're pulling from. So I kind of know and I can navigate through. Some of this, because it's pulling from Chinese folk tales and legends and myths that I'm completely unfamiliar with, I don't really know the, like, obvious little clues. This is where this is going. This person's going to do it. So it's so much more vibrant and fresh to me.
Yes, yeah, so it's definitely maybe a growing trend and just something to keep an eye on to see what is that movie going to be sort of a tipping point. You know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was great, but then nothing really followed it up. So it'll be just interesting to see what's the tipping point. What's number four?
Well, talking about Crouching Tiger for just a second, that movie, Ang Lee used that as a springboard to make American films. And you know, he didn't necessarily try to stay and make films for a domestic audience. I think more and more those directors will choose to stay.
So number four.
Well, I had a couple things I was going to mention. You know, and I will mention the first two briefly. Over the past couple of weeks, the news broke that Ryan Reynolds is looking to remake the beloved, and by beloved I mean beloved by me, 1980s movie Clue.
Oh, that was one of my favorite movies growing up.
Curious about that. And also, you know, news broke that Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda, and Dolly Parton are on board with remaking 9 to 5, and I'm beyond the movie excited about that, too. But the thing I want to talk about most is this, since we last spoke, the cast list for Quentin Tarantino's upcoming film, 2019 film, was released. And it's just an incredible who's who. I mean, you have Margot Robbie, Luke Perry, Dakota Fanning, Al Pacino, Burt Reynolds, not to mention the top head leads are Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. I mean, you could not ask for a more outstanding cast. I'm so excited for this movie.
So, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes, it's going to be. I mean, you know, and top it all off, it's dealing with the Manson murders. So you know, it seems like something that is right up Tarantino's alley, and the movie will be released on approximately the 50th anniversary of the Manson murders.
Well,
so,
and this seems like it's setting up to be
a disappointment.
The first real Tarantino blockbuster in a way.
Yeah, certainly.
This sort of seems to be because of the cast. Exactly what you're saying. It's sort of very exciting, but it seems to put it in some ways at a different marketing angle than maybe some of his other movies have been. That maybe it'll have a little bit of a wider appeal in some of the marketing than just as a Tarantino film.
I don't know what the situation was. Yeah, certainly. I mean, because Leo and Brad Pitt together feels like just a marketer's dream, right?
Well,
I mean,
and with them, like you might even think that it's with them. You might even think it's actually a Scorsese film rather than a Tarantino one.
And you know, look, the casting Burt Reynolds is insanely like just ballsy move, but at the same time, you hear it and you're like, makes sense. That's good. That's good. And the other thing is, you know, even though he's been acting steadily, Al Pacino needs needs a comeback hit. He needs a capper at this point, right?
I think so, yeah. It's the type of... And Tarantino is the best director, I think, out there to provide actors with their best opportunity to do that.
That's right. That's so. Right. And I cannot... And on the other hand, you know, I'm insanely curious about... Luke Perry's in this movie? Like, what is Luke Perry doing in a movie with... I mean, like, what world are we in where Luke Perry is acting alongside these people?
He's, you know, he's doing the John Travolta role. That's
exactly
what he's doing.
But, you know, and you just... it just sounds like it could be a lot of fun. Kurt Russell is apparently in a small role in the movie. You wonder if somehow Samuel L. Jackson will work his way into the movie. You kind of think he will. I mean, you know, that's just what's going to happen.
Yeah, Danny Trejo somewhere.
The only thing I will say is, especially since the movie is coming out right at the 50th anniversary of Sharon Tate's death, there are going to be people that are going to be upset that that's exploitive. And a little, you know, tacky, and so it'll be interesting to see how they approach the marketing of it, and also how respectful they are with, you know, what, how do you portray the Manson killings in a way that doesn't sensationalize and glorify them? You know, so there's some tricky sort of artistic ways through there that Tarantino loves to flirt with that line. You know, like, let's think about what he did with Inglourious Basterds, where he, you know, he loves to sort of thread that needle and make it to where I'm sort of crossing the line and making something okay that shouldn't be okay, but I'm staying just safe on this edge of it, so we'll see how it works.
So that'll be intriguing on many levels. So number three is something that really just broke in recent days that I find really intriguing. It's also about a casting announcement. J.J. Abrams came out and said that both Luke and Leia will appear in Star Wars Episode 9. To me, the news about Luke is not that big of a deal. It's kind of letting the cat out of the bag a little bit earlier. And maybe that's been influenced by some poor choices Abrams has made in the past about saying, oh, no, this is not this, and then people kind of feeling like he'd been lied to. The fact that Luke comes back, Force Ghost or in some other way, it kind of makes sense. I think we were all maybe kind of expecting
that. Well, the Leia thing, I'm of two minds about the Leia thing, because one, Kathleen Kennedy, who is like the overseer of the Star Wars movies for Marvel, for Disney at this point, she comes out and says, like, within months of the movie, she said, no, we are not going to use any more footage of Leia. We're not going to recast her. Leia's done. We're done with that. We're not going to do that. And so now they are, they were obviously real touchy about using CGI because they didn't want to, because they didn't want a backlash. They didn't want to be disrespectful. So they wanted to, you know, do that the right way. So apparently they found unused footage from The Last Jedi they're going to use, which normally probably would have made it onto the director's cut or deleted scene on that DVD. They now saved to put in Episode 9, of what it sounds like.
Well, and I couldn't remember in the story I read if it was The Last Jedi or it was actually in what Abrams had filmed in The Force Awakens. But either way, it has her daughter's blessing.
It has
Jennifer's
blessing, yeah.
And my guess is, you know, Kathleen Kennedy said that in the aftermath, and that was the right thing to say, I think. But, you know, they brought Abrams in, I think, in part because they had to figure out the story now that they couldn't do anything with Leia, anything new maybe that was planned. And I think, in that sense, it to me, it feels a little more organic. And the idea that plans change.
Well, I think they brought Abrams back in part because I think the backlash to Last Jedi rattled some nerves, and while the numbers, the box office numbers, were still there, because it's a Star Wars movie and people are going to go see it, I think they are scared that people aren't going to continue to go see those movies, so they want to, you know, they don't want to, again, not to belabor the phrase, but they're trying to thread a needle too, which is they got to appeal to these hardcore fans, but they also want to. They also don't want to catch criticism for not doing something new. So, and I get it. Part of it, from a storytelling perspective, it's going to be really awkward if Leia just disappears. like, it's, you know, she survived. Ideally, she should have died in Last Jedi.
Instead of flying like Superwoman back to a ship, yeah.
Would have made it so much better.
Now, I say that sort of pejoratively and snarkily, but I will say this. I think The Last Jedi gets better upon second viewings. It's a little bloated. They could have cut that casino planet, you know, sequences, scenes in half. I think it will be really interesting. See how this does this. I just think it's amazing they announced it this far out in advance.
As far as Billy Lord's blessing, you know, I would think that they're going to pay her her mom's estate an enormous amount of money. Why would she not say yes to that? It's not going to. I mean, in no way is it. You know, and she knows that they're not going to be disrespectful to her mother in any way because it's not in their interest to do
and
so.
And who knows? She may have thought it would have been weird too not to have Leia there. The only way I've said this before, probably on this podcast, the only scenario that really made sense was if they started episode 9 with the funeral for Leia, or I think, and you had actually suggested this, the crawl said began with Princess Leia Organa is dead. Like, that's the only way that those two things could have worked,
and
without having that footage. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I want to go on and get to number 2 before we get too close to time. I don't have enough time to talk about 2 and 1. So 2, really quick. Disney, Fox, the deal's finalized. I don't know how much to really say about that at this time, other than it just raises so many questions. So I'm going to hit just a couple of the questions I have. So here they are in no particular order. 1, are we going to finally get a good Fantastic Four movie?
Yes. Two,
are we going to fold in the current X-Men continuity of films? And 3, are we going to get Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart back for
at least
one
more
X-Men
film? The only thing I can tell you with, I think, some degree of certainty is Hugh Jackman, that Wolverine, stays. Like, you're not going to undo that. Professor X, you've already sort of undone it by having younger versions with Fassbender and James McAvoy. So I think you're sort of already got people okay with the idea of other people being Professor X and Magneto. But Hugh Jackman is Wolverine in the same way that Robert Downey Jr. is Iron Man. And I think it would be incredibly disappointing and a big letdown if somehow they did not have those two people on screen as their characters at least once.
So it just
I'm almost positive at some point you're going to want to have. And I know he's in a post-credit scene or whatever, but if there is to be a Deadpool 3, you do want Wolverine to have some part of that.
That would be awesome. So right now, yeah, a big story. But I don't want to give too much time to it because really it's just about all of our fanboy questions. We could go on it tonight among those. And I want to get to number 1 because it's also connected to Marvel, but it's also connected again. It's what I would call the next stage in this ongoing cultural conversation. I guess you can say sparked by the Me Too movement and other things. But 2 things I see tied together, the Netflix comedy special Nanette, and then James Gunn being fired from Guardians of the Galaxy due to old tweets. So tell me how you think maybe some of that stuff all connects together, how it represents kind of a new part of the conversation.
Well, we are, it feels like it's much older, but the Me Too movement, the whole thing started approximately a year ago with the first of many now Ronan Farrow exposés taking down powerful people in
an era where fake news gets bandied about way too much. Ronan Farrow is a badass.
Yeah, he is. And while we just briefly to go off on a bit of a side tangent, you know, Ronan Farrow, I personally, in my own theory, is that Ronan Farrow's commitment to uprooting sexual abuse and misconduct wherever he finds it, I think is born out of his resentment and attitude towards his father, Woody Allen. I think he's determined. He said, "You may get away with it, but I'm gonna take down everyone else I can."
Right. You think?
And I think that's why he thinks that is his personal mission is to focus on these types of stories.
I don't think that's much of a side tangent. I agree. The movement is still young, and that's why I feel like this is like a next jump.
Yes.
In stage in the conversation. The Nanette special it provoked a lot of reflection
powerful.
In both of us.
It was so powerful. And in one way, you know, it's one of those things too where it was rightfully called a comedy special because the first probably 30, 40 minutes of it were pretty daggum funny. But at a certain point, it became something that was not really a comedy special anymore. It was more, and I'm hesitant to even call it a confessional or a personal memoir, but it was an indictment. It was a searing, like just personal outpouring of all the emotions you can think of that go along with the issues we're talking about. But it's also, in a real way, a personification and a humanizing of a subject that too many of us forget deals with actual people.
Well, and it was, I think the two takeaways, and to tie this more directly into the issues going on now with Gunn and now other figures in culture, you know, baseball players, that sort of stuff, old tweets sort of being dragged up. Nanette, to me, was about telling your story. The performer herself said that, and about, you know, yeah, you want to call Picasso a genius, but he was also a misogynist. And you got to tell both sides of that, and that to me is a bit of what was going on in now in this conversation. Is how do we tell our full story with authenticity, and integrity, and how do we make sense of some of the very poor attitudes, judgments that people may have made at a younger stage? Where does forgiveness come in? Where does accountability come in? You know, I think with Gunn, I think old tweets, without any other proof of any other poor behavior, I think that's a different sort than what Harvey Weinstein has done,
but, you know, but it depends,
what Louis C.K. has done.
Because even then, like this rash of baseball players is happening too, when some of the material that you're talking about is vilely racist material, okay, we're not talking about 20, 30 years ago, we're talking about, okay, you were 18 years old, it was 2000, or it was 2005, and you didn't know better than to say that in a public forum. Like, what does that say about who you are? And it does say something. And you can't say, I was younger 5 years ago. You weren't that much younger. What it is, you're just now in a position where people care and are calling you out on it.
So it creates, for me, the other thing it does is it reminds us that there is always some subjectivity to these conversations. And subjectivity does not necessarily mean that you can't say whether something's good or bad and saying it's all relative. But it just means there's a lot more nuance to be had in these conversations, and that it is at times dangerous to draw too many absolutes, and that we just have to confront our own biases and blind spots in these conversations.
I say
all this as a white male. I have privilege. I'm still speaking from not a great sense
of
urgency or fear.
And I feel this myself too. And I think a lot of people, that when people want to defend, and I think, and at the end of the day, I think if James Gunn is not reinstated as the Guardians 3 director, he will, I think, have a home in Marvel soon. I don't think they're going to cut ties with him completely, because I think the people involved in those movies have too much of a respect and relationship with him that I think it would make coming into it as another director difficult. So I think eventually he will find a home. Now, whether or not it's there, or maybe it's still involved in the cosmic side of the, you know, just storyboarding ideas, he'll have a role. I don't think they're going to cut him out, because I think he's too intricately involved, and the people there are on his side. Because I know today they released a letter signed by all of the people. And it's funny, the letter didn't say signed by the people who play. It said signed Guardians of the Galaxy. It's the most classy name.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it just points to this ongoing conversation. This is really what films do in the first place for us. They at their best prompt good questions and exploration of what it means to be human, what it means to be a community. So we thank you, listeners, for giving us some of your time to listen to us talk about that, reflect on that. Remember that you can see us on Twitter at 10K Movies, T-E-N-K Movies, or on Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. We'll try to be back in another 2 weeks, but who knows? My hope is that as we go into this last year, we'll have at least one episode a month. I think we can swing that, and if we're lucky, we'll have two. But until next time, we hope that your week is a 10.
10 plus.
Border on the left.